most people have been here before, but just in case someone knew, I'm Susan Chinska. Fire exits are through that door or that door, and you just follow your nose as if it's fairly straightforward. This talk, as with all the others, will be recorded, and then the talks, the slides and the recording go onto the website, and we do know that people are listening to them, people who can't make it first tonight. So your questions will be included in that, and Ruth would like questions at the end rather than as we're going through. And so that brings me to So this evening, I'm very pleased to welcome Ruth Jenkins, whom I think quite a lot of people here will know. Ruth is going to draw together the threads of the history lectures that we've had through the year, through her talk tonight. I feel it is a very appropriate way of concluding this lecture programme. This is the last one of the series, and I think looking at the story of Fairfield, I think through a virtual walk around the reserve, though that's all a little bit high-tech for me, so I couldn't expose any more than that. But I think it's a very good way of actually concluding these talks. And I also think it's very good that we have Ruth, who's delivering this lecture, as a younger member of our community, and one who grew up in Fairfield, and for whom this whole area has always been very important. So let me hand over to Ruth. Thank you.
Thanks, Sue, for the introduction. As Sue said, I'm from Lancaster, and I've grown up here, and I'm still living in the same house on Fairfield. And this place does mean a lot to me, and it's nice to see so many people here who want to hear some of the story of this place. I will be maybe recapping some stuff that you might have heard in previous lectures, but I hope I'm adding some new things as well. So, I want to take you on a journey through the site, and my journeys always start with Sunnyside Lane, and this is because this is where I live. But it's always been a kind of escape for me to get out to Fairfield, you know, go for a walk, go somewhere different, somewhere that you feel kind of connected to the countryside and just a stone's throw away. But, so this is Sunnyside Lane. I've been walking down this street for quite a long time, starting with me and my dad. And invariably, it would end up at the play park me and my little sister there, or at the allotments. I think I'm suitably embarrassed my sister now. So that's the lens through which I see Fairfield. It's part of my history and the history of my family, and still continues to be. So I thought this is where I want to start. Now, most people, well, if you come from this side and come from Sunnyside Lane, you'll end up at the White Palm House or Edenbreck. It's always been a landmark, I think, for quite a lot of people. And I've looked up meanings of the place names around this area. They're all so unusual in a lot of ways. And Breck from the Norse, according to the article I read, meaning bank, or possibly Eden from the Celtic meaning river or water. And a lot of the place names seem to have this connection with water. But if we walk down the lane a bit further, and we go along the Fauna Path, you see the water everywhere. You see it on the whole site. You see the water, and I know that's been part of the deliberate changes in the landscape that have happened recently for the wetland birds and wildlife. And it's quite interesting that there is this old connection with water as well. Not least with Carr House Farm. And Carr being an old word for fen woodland with ash and willow. But it may also be important that it was boggy and wetland for one of the finds that has t- turned up from the land. Now, I know these were found by the Lotson family on their land, and I know they haven't been seen by an expert. I'm not an expert, but I have done a little bit of reading around the topic, and I found this really interesting thing, that they are Neolithic axe heads from the Stone Age, and they possibly, well, they're polished, this one on the top. There's three of them. This one at the top is one of the larger one at the bottom here, I think. And they are possibly from the early Neolithic and have been polished by rubbing against another stone. And the rounded end would have gone into the axe handle, and the other end would have been the cutting edge. But someone called David Barraclough, who's written a book called Prehistoric Lancashire, suggested that the ones with flattened sides, and I don't know whether you can just see that it's got along the edge, they're a bit flattened, were possibly from a feature of the ones that are made in the Lake District. And that they are then produced there, and then they were shipped all over the country. Well, not necessarily shipped, but by people moved around the country. And it's interesting they end up here as well. And again, they haven't been looked at by an expert, but the idea with some places and some finds of these axe heads is they're put there deliberately, not used, but put in the ground or in parts of cliff edges on the north of Morecambe Bay, as a kind of maybe a ritual, or maybe to mark a special place. And I think that's quite interesting, as for me Fairfield is a special place, and that maybe people as far back as between 2700 BC and 2000 BC thought that this might be a special place. And I'm sure a lot of other people find it an interesting place to be. If we go further, also the names with water come up again and again. So Swallowholm and Sourholm being two old names for the fields that are now flora and fauna. Holm, again from the Old Norse, meaning an area that is covered by water or a prominence in a boggy area. And sour meaning unsuitable for ploughing. So again, water everywhere, part of the landscape, and it still is. Moving forward again in history, we get, maybe this might have been another thing dropped, and apologies for the really bad picture. This is a Roman coin that was found by the metal detectorists on the site, and dates from about 300 AD. And it links in maybe with other finds, that there's a Roman gravestone found along Oldcliff Road during excavation quite a few years ago. But the idea that people knew of this site and maybe dropped their coins here, I find quite interesting, all that hundreds and hundreds of years ago. But they weren't just dropping things, they were farming here. And this is, with some of you who may come to Mike Darvish's lecture, have heard about the Linchets, these lines on the fields, made maybe deliberately or accidentally by the Middle Ages, in the medieval ploughmen, going along the slope with their oxen and pushing the earth over on the same side all the time. And at least for since the 1090s, we know that land from in this area was given to the priory, land at Aldcliffe was given to the priory during the Norman era and the Abbey of Sayes. So they were farming this land for at least since then, probably earlier. But in 1192, the burgesses of Lancaster and the townspeople were given strips of land in the Lancaster Charter all around Lancaster. But this is one of the places where you can still see those strips of land and where they farmed. And they were given, they had their townhouse in the town, and then they had their fields out in all around the edges of Lancaster at that time. But it was a hive of activity, and people didn't just pass through this site. They came here to work, and they farmed and increased their income, not just for their family, but for someone elsewhere as well. And they dropped things as well, and these are little lead weights. They may not just drop things, but the night soil and things like that were also ploughed into the land, so finds could have ended up on the land in different ways. But these are from the 14th and 15th centuries. And then you come to Elizabeth I, and as Elizabeth I wrote, one of several found on the site by the metal detectorists again. And at this point, land's getting more aggregated into bigger plots and bigger landowners. But it's not just working. I think some recreation is found on the site as well. And you basically chart the history of pipe smoking through the different clay pipes that are found on the site. Again, by the metal detectorists in the process of detecting the land, they found these. And this, from like as early as 1600, you get the little tiny ones that can only fit a very small amount of tobacco because it's so expensive. And gradually they get bigger and bigger. This is one of my favourite finds. It is from 1784, which is quite an important time for Lancaster, with the port being built in 1750, between 1750 and 1755. And this is a custom seal that would have been on a bale of flax. And this particular one, on the other side, says it's from St. Petersburg. And even if this piece of land now feels isolated, at one point it wasn't. It was really connected, at least to the rest of Europe. But flax for Lancaster was quite an important thing. They brought it in, they processed it, and they turned it into linen for sailcloth to support the shipping trade that was going on in Lancaster at that time. But like the shipping trade, it was a bit of a boom and bust. But in the 1890s, not very long after that, the Napoleonic Wars and the decline in the sugar trade meant that the flax trade as well collapsed. But I read this very interesting article by someone called Margaret Robinson, and she suggested that one of the people who was manufacturing flax, the Edmondson family, had a factory on Oldcliff Lane. And I'm not sure exactly where Oldcliff Lane is now, whether it's the old name for Oldcliff Road, but it seems quite close by, which is it's just really nice in a way. You know, you have this link between Lancaster and the town, with the Fairfield Fields and the town, that maybe we don't make these days, but certainly there's big connections and connections worldwide. And I just wanted to stop here at this kind of beauty spot on our trip, because this is Pony Wood up here with our backs to Oldcliff, and this site seems to me to have a lot of connections between places and paths, and one of the connections for me is with Oldcliff, because Oldcliff, not just for the medieval monks coming through who had their lands at Oldcliff, so they must have passed through this at some point, and Mike Derbyshire suggested that Sunnyside Lane might be that old connection, and it's big enough to get a cart through. But also moving on to a time when Catholics were persecuted in Lancaster, Oldcliff Hall was a safe house, so you may have had people going there to hear mass and passing through this site to be able to get there as a safe haven where they could practice their religion. But it's also a nice point to think of a more modern story, and I know some of you may also have heard this with the Loxton family and their connection to this particular patch of land, going back at least to the 1891 census, as far as I can tell, and that they and the kind of community that grew up around the dairy production at that time, and the kind of way people helped each other out during the Second World War, and the connections, you know, with the excess milk production and trading it round, maybe outside rationing, but and the story of the drill hut under the bridge, and they used to swap rations and for milk, which I found was quite nice, and this kind of community. Okay, maybe the state wouldn't have seen it as quite like that, but I see it as kind of community helping itself through a difficult time. This is the end of Sunnyside Lane, and again, there is a sense of history walking down these paths, even if they may have changed over time, and they're certainly changing now. But it's, again, I still feel like you feel the footsteps of other people who've walked down here before you, And I quite like that connection that you can find through walking through some fields, which some people might think are just backdrop, but there are so many other things there to discover. Not least the White Pot Kettle, which brings us kind of right up to date, and the way in which people today are kind of, this land has a history of farming, and it's still being farmed today, but it's now being farmed with a view to conservation as well, and almost there's a bit of a change from farming to recreation for the people who visit and walk through, but it's still quite important. And the cattle playing an important role in that conservation to keep the grass down, to encourage wildflowers, but also ground nesting birds later in the year and things like that. I find it quite interesting, those connections between the historical and the conservation and current uses of the land. And again, water, Lucy Brook and Beck, and the word Beck again, Norse. And I'm not sure why Old Norse keeps coming up with these names, but the sources that I've found suggest that this is where some of the original identifiers of the land came from, the Norse language. And then we come right up to the orchard, and this is kind of played quite an important part in my family as well, this orchard that I find it quite fantastic that it's the community who's come together to create a space where the community can enjoy the natural landscape, but also have a crop, have apples, have a space to walk your dog, to be away from the town. But also we use this as a family for my grandparents' wedding anniversary photographs. We came here for their 50th wedding anniversary and had some photographs taken. 60th, sorry. But going back from those Stone Age axe heads, that we're now putting our mark in stone as a community for the future. And this piece of land that is rented for, was it 9,000 years? Or 900 years, I can't remember the exact figure. And it continues with the fauna path, with the flora fields, but that sense of passing something forward to the next generation, which creating our own history as a community, but also respecting the history that's gone before. So that's the site now, and all these little things seem to be part of it, and so is the human interaction with the site, right from the Neolithic stone axe heads. Maybe they just left them there because they thought it was a beautiful place, or we don't know, we can only speculate. Or Romans who kind of walked through, maybe on their way to the forts on Castle Hill, dropping a few coins. But then the more connection with the land itself in the farming and the Old Cliff and the gift from the Abbey to the Abbey of Sais. So the monks from the priory, who were never very many, there's only about 20 or 40 of them, they were never a huge number, who would go off and farm their land at Aldcliffe. And then the first charter, again, that giving the strips to the people of Lancaster to farm them in their own right, rather than being under the lord. And then moving forward again, the medieval period, when the Scottish army in 1323 trampled the land, and this is a story that Mike Derbyshire told, that the land was owned originally by the the Earl of Lancaster at that time, but he was executed as a traitor for helping the Scots, and his land was then passed to the crown, and so land around Sourholme, now part of Flora, was degraded in value by the Scottish horses being basically stabled there, I suppose, for 4 days. And other smaller landholders having to sell their land because it was so degraded they couldn't get an income from it. And then the English Civil War, and at that point when Catholic families were having a huge amount of problems with the state. And then Aldcliffe being a safe house for them, but Aldcliffe also was home to Seven Sisters, Catholic girls who put this on their lintel above their front door to try and get some protection from the parliamentarians, and they won't touch the stone is now in the Lancaster Cathedral. And then moving on, and you get the key, and then you get the flax coin, the flax seal dropped on the fields. And again, there's this interaction between people and the landscape, and the ploughing and changing that landscape, adding finds to it for the next generations to find, but also using it productively. Or at that time, it was owned by bigger landholders who started putting farmers onto that land to farm it separately. And then, of course, the opening of Lancaster Canal must have changed everything dramatically, suddenly having this waterway that you couldn't cross very easily, going straight down the side. And then, again, with the First and Second World Wars, obviously must have had a huge impact on Lancaster in general. But then you get the Fairfield Association, and the impact that we've had on that land as a community, but also as the association, and the changes that are very much forward-looking for the natural landscape and the historical, preserving that history for future generations. So this, I took this off the Fairfield website. The people at the moment I see as some of the people who are making the biggest impacts on the land and interacting most with it are volunteers. And I think the work they do, such as the hedge laying or the hay baling, and that look back to the history of the land and how it was used before, as well as looking forward to the future. Now, that's all I have to say. I'm sorry if I spoke quite quickly. I hope you're following me. If anyone has any questions, but I also would like to throw it open to for people to share some of their histories of the landscape if they want to, or their connection with Fairfield, because I'd be really interested to hear it. Thank you.
May I? Yes.
Yeah.
I cannot find on the 1845 ordnance map any reference to Fairfield. Do you know when the name originated, when and how and why?
I'm not sure. I know that there's Fairfield Hall, which is on Redfords.
Yes.
Yeah. And there was a field, basically Redford Ashfield area. Apart from that, I don't
just
know.
The name of one of the surrounding fields.
Yeah.
May I also ask, you showed a photograph of Lucy Brook.
Yeah.
At that point, he's right outside my garden gate, as it happens. Do you know where the path from the orchard reaches Lucy Brook? The path turns sharp right for 70 or 80 yards, and then sharp left. But on this map, it goes straight ahead.
Yeah.
There was a footbridge there over the brook,
and
the brook was obviously culverted underneath the path up to my garden gate. And to that point where you showed it coming out under the stone bridge. Do you know anything about the why and the when of that?
No, but I Mike obviously did mention that the path had changed from one that went to Aldcliffe to one that went off to one side. I'm not sure
this,
why.
This map shows it carrying on in the line, the original line of the path from the orchard, and meeting where the path is now, just about where there's a hawthorn tree halfway along from Lucy Brook to where you meet the farm lane.
Yeah.
But then it follows round towards the left behind Pony Wood, and presumably it goes off from that, it reaches up Old Cliff Road there.
Yeah.
But it didn't seem to be going directly towards Old Cliff.
No.
Ian, did you want to make a...
Well, just to add to what Phillips said, the mystery is not just why the path suddenly takes a dog lane when the straight narrow is straight ahead, but why did they culvert 50 metres of Lucy Brook? It must have been quite a big undertaking, and I can't for the life of me work out why you have to put a stream underground
for that
last point. I don't know whether anyone else has any theories about it. It's it's a real mystery to me.
Certainly it's something that when the Lobsons get their talk, they mentioned it, and they used to have problems working on the land, and the call that certainly helped them to work the land better, so as drainage. So it presumably predates them, but I would imagine it's to do with the ability to work the land and even drainage to stop flooding.
No, it's the footpath.
Yeah.
You know, the culvert is the footpath.
I know.
So it's between two hedgerows. One has just been destroyed. it's not in the land that would be worked at all.
Well,
I think
the Lobsons
are talking about the land in what we call Big Meadow, going down to this point, roughly, where there is some kind of drain, culverted drain. But it's this little bit that mystifies me as well as Philip here.
Yeah, I mean, it cuts off a corner of the field, effectively forming a triangle.
If I go back, you're talking about here.
If you put a little red light on the path at the top as it comes from the orchard.
This is the orchard down here,
yeah,
and then it's that's
there.
That's
now
the point.
Carry straight on.
Yeah.
It
would have carried on here.
It would have gone straight and behind Lucy Wood.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's a bit behind Pony Wood.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you can see where that dogleg is. The original Basque formed what we could regard now as the base of a triangle. Mm-hmm. With the two bits of dogleg forming the sides of the triangle. And it's just strange. It's as if somebody's tried to create a right angle in the corner of the figure from their purpose.
I don't have a solution either. But there is another kind of element to the conundrum which might eventually help. The corner of the field that Philip is talking about, which where you've got the dog leg and it would have gone straight across, I think not right up at the top, but just across that little corner on the field. Can I show you?
It might be easy.
It's just a straight line.
So it's. I think the footpath would have gone like that.
That's right.
Yeah.
It would have gone straight up there. Mm-hmm. And this triangle here, I think, although I'd have to go back and look,
relates, I think, to the ownership of the land. So when we bought the largest lump of flora land from the Harris family, it included a triangle in that field, which I think is roughly where that is. The rest of that field was owned by Gleason, the developer. So it looks as if at some point in the past, differential ownership related to either side of what the original was.
And that might have linked to the original strip farms way back, because they were aggregated in very different ways and never marked by boundaries. So the documents from that era define the landscape as in who owned the land on one side, who owned the land on the other, and then who owned the tiny bit in the middle, you know. So there was like there's a small bit of Napa land.
Yeah, that's the one. Can you point it out, that
is
one
it,
there?
Is it
the
here?
One, the one, yes, where the house, that's it, you're going down the line of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the demarcation of an original strip. If I can just point out. Oh, sorry. It's the bit with the there. That's it.
Yeah.
That's the line of an original strip which belonged to a charitable lady, and it passed on through charitable hands. Right up until the day we bought it, that just one strip like that. So that's very good evidence of history within the landscape.
Mm. You mentioned Aldcliffe Hall.
Yeah.
And there were what, seven sisters?
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly the number, but Aldcliffe Hall was owned by a Catholic family who eventually had to give it up because of the the costs of fines for not going to hear Anglican church services. But they had two houses, during the Civil War, the woman and the family were in that house. I'm not sure the exact number.
You said they had some name.
Yeah, they put up on the front of the door saying, "We're seven Catholic sisters, leave us alone, please," basically. and apparently it worked. So, but the hall is long since gone, but that stone is in the cathedral.
Where is, or where was, Old Cliff Hall?
I'm not sure exactly.
It was more or less where very modern houses that were finished. So there's still a bit of the farm on the edge of it. But you can see the boundary of the old hall.
It was only destroyed, I think, in the 1960s. I mean, there might be people here who remember the remnants of the hall, but anyone has lived here longer than that? No.
As a boy, I wonder if you claim in your research, growing up, there was the Long Pads, otherwise known as Kendall Padfields, and the Short Pads, which comes out of Carter House. And I was always told that it was a pack horse trail from Preston to Kendall. Have you found anything out about
that? No, I haven't. And that's the one name that I didn't look up, was the Pads, because it's one that people use, but I've hardly had to find the risk of that word.
That's interesting, because that might say, because it's called Kendall Pads, isn't it? So
that's
that
right.
Fits in with that.
Yeah.
I can't remember where I've read this, but I've read it somewhere, that the name Pads is linked to Paddock, and is linked to the building of the canal.
Yeah.
And the canal was not just for transporting goods, but for transporting passengers. The name Waterwich is the name of one of the kind of express boats that were worked from Preston to Kendal. And if you think just opposite the triangle, alongside the canal, do people know what I mean by the triangle now? There is an odd-shaped building, which is obviously part of the canal. It's like a kind of building over the canal.
Mm.
And that was where these express boats that had a particular name that I can't remember, packet boats, that's right. That's where they were berthed. Now, what I read was that the horses that pulled these boats were meadowed overnight, putting fields overnight in the fields that we now call Flora. And the Pad's footpath was named because of the horse paddock.
Right.
Now, I can't remember where I've read that, but I haven't just dreamt it, I'm sure.
Rather than being stabled.
They obviously wanted feed, so they rented these fields to feed the horses.
It's interesting that you've mentioned Kendall Pads, because I had never heard of that phrase until earlier this afternoon. And I was meeting with Helen Hicks, who's a very involved member, and she was telling us about some research that she did probably about 10 years ago now. And that she referred to the footpath that is the original one before we put the orchard in.
Yeah.
There's still a footpath to the left of that.
That's right.
That goes alongside Big Meadow. And she referred to that as Kendall Pads.
That's right.
And in her research, it was because she said the monks, I think, Mandy, came up from perhaps the Preston area, but certainly from and passed down that path up to the prior and gradually onto Kendall. And I'm sure she said they were bringing salt, but presumably they were bringing other things. The monks from Coxham up to the priory in Lancaster and then they would either go up to Kendal or they would go over the sands to Carmel. So Helen has said for a good 10 years that the monks have used that particular path for 500 years or more.
Yeah. And it's interesting, Copper Sands did have land was gifted to the abbeys, and particularly Copper Sands, and land in Sarholm, which was gifted at one point to the Abbey of Copper Sands. It was a bigger establishment, a lot bigger than the priory, monastery rather than
prior. Just to pick up on the point Ian made about the packet boats,
yeah,
and the building where Ballinburgh started, the map shows the packet station there between Penny Bridge and Whitecross Mill alongside the canal. Mm.
So that's farther along.
It's not much. Stations.
Well, there might be more than one.
There might be. It's just about 100 yards apart.
Interesting.
I just wanted to point out that actually one of the things that this discussion illustrates is that people tend to have very firm views about what is the case about history, including the meanings and names.
Yeah.
Usually because somebody else they knew told them, and these things get passed down in oral traditions, but they're not necessarily accurate. And I think one of the problems that we have with all of this is knowing which of the alternative explanations one might want to believe. For example, the word paths could well be related etymologically to the word path, and in footpaths down in London.
Yes.
So I think there are alternative explanations,
yeah,
and I don't think we have a solution.
Yeah.
And it's not the only conundrum that's like that in the area. The other one that interests me, but which we've never found a solution to, has to do with the concrete wall on the footpath, which is on the bend of the footpath, which is said perhaps to be have been put there by somebody who was an early experimenter in concrete in the early 20th century. And we had quite a long discussion in another lecture about the strange concrete object in Flora Field quite near Orchid Road. There's something in there which various people in this room declared was a cattle trough or an animal trough for cattle and sheep. But the county archaeologist who lives in Carhouse Lane thinks that it might well have been a stand on which a pumping engine might have been put to pump water from the field into the canal some time ago. And the evidence in favour of that is the internal construction of this apparent water trough.
Yeah.
It's a big water trough anyway, but inside it's divided up into 8 rectangles by brick walls. That doesn't look like the kind of thing that you would do if you were creating a cattle trough. But we don't have a solution to it. And what we could really do is somebody who would really work away at these things and find us solutions. Whether it's possible to find a solution,
no,
is not so clear.
Whether or not.
Do you know anything about the White Cottage?
Not really, no. I don't. I looked into. I hadn't had a chance to look into the Warwick Cottage. I knew it's on some older maps, but I haven't had a chance to look into that. Sorry.
Is that Edenbreck? Is it Edenbreck Farm?
Edenbreck
Farm. Does anybody else here know the history of Edenbreck Farm?
If you look at the earlier maps, it was at one point a barn. It's on the map as a barn. So it looks as if it was probably converted from a stone barn into a cottage at some point. So it hasn't always been a cottage.
Maybe it was a barn to start with before people were living on their farms and then changed as people started to live onto the land.
Mm. Mm. Not even the same shape as the cottage.
I was always told that Carhouse Farm, which belongs to the Loxers, and has done for generations, I'm using the wrong term here. Old man Loxham has sons, and he wanted somewhere for those sons to live and farm. So he built the white farm for one of his sons. And the other son, he built Ripley Farm. They were all owned by Loxhams. It was like a triangle of Loxhams.
Because there's joy, can I think there's joy, and then, yeah?
Back to names, really. I've always been fascinated by Holywood, called Holywood. I mean, it sounds obvious because where ponies were kept. What was it? And how long has it been called Holywood?
It's not an ancient woodland, that's as Claire Harris was talking previously, and she said it's not an ancient woodland, it's pretty much all the same age, and it was probably linked to the kind of building the drive for Old Hall much later, I don't know.
Yes, it's a night. Yeah. From Mr. Bellis's paper on Arcliffe, it seems to have been a landscape feature put there in the 19th century by the people who lived in Arcliffe Hall when the hall was rebuilt. And it's there to create a nice landscape for people to look down towards the castle. So their view of the castle in the prior wasn't obscure, but they've got nice features on the landscape. And it has got trees in it, like sweet chestnut, and sort of all that would have been considered natural, but also ornamental. So it's probably a very recent name. Maybe it sounds a little bit as though it sounded a nice name for someone might give it.
Mm. It certainly wasn't shown on the 1845 map.
Oh, wasn't it?
No, there are other woodlands shown, but not that.
Should we take Tony in that ear?
Yes, sir. Well, Tricia and I were, as you know, working up there with the school. Yeah, Barris and Tricia now, as you come and say. We were up there this sort of working with. There were so many times up there, and the children were always asking me, why is it called Ponywood? Why is it? Lots of the girls in the group who were 8, 9 years old were really, really expecting to find full of ponies, were they? Why they weren't in the ponies. And that was, they'd been waiting all year to go to the Ponywood. We came up with this thing, well, why is it called Ponywood? And Tricia, who came up with the idea, and I think this is a really, really lovely one, a romantic one, this, and that the children from Old Cliff Hall, when the wood was built, they would ride up there with their little ponies and have a picnic. And they went so many times up there and had such a lovely time that they called it Holy Wood.
And I'm prepared to believe.
And the children.
That's gone down. As Mick was saying now, I'm sorry about this, Mick, but 300 children in Lancaster now. They in turn will have 300 more children.
600. Oliver Fulton thinks that it's because that area was used for exercising ponies, and that may connect up with Ian's story about the.
Just to link back to the Loxham family, I was speaking to Robin Loxham the other day, but not our Robin Loxham, rather his nephew, who is the son of David Loxham, who was here.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, David has passed away. But
David.
Yes. But his son, I met him at the bottom of Sunnyside Lane on a Fairfield business matter, and he said, "My dad was born here." That's the White Cottage at Edenbrake Cottage. So the Loxham family have been in that cottage for a couple of generations.
That figures of what the gentleman there said, wasn't it, about the Loxham family providing for their son. Now we've got the lady at the back and then John.
Difficult question you might not be able to answer, but you didn't go into much detail about the Georgian period, and I wondered, given the Georgians were so instrumental and fundamental to Lancaster's history, what influence they had on this area, if any, for for good or ill, what impact did they have?
Well, we know that there's quite a lot of Georgian coins that come off the site where the metal detector is found. And also that by that point they kind of aggregated the land a lot more, so that there was some key landholders like the Rawlinson family, who and the Dawson family. So some key big families in Lancaster owned these bits of land, and then had tenant farmers in those bits of land. So you see a change to more to animals rather than crops as well around that time, I think.
The photographs of the finds are on the website, aren't they? That the metal did. So there were a lot of, as Will said, a lot of Georgian coins. And we.
I just wondered if they used it recreationally at all, you know, because it was so close to, you know,
London. No, it was rather modern game
than
that. It was the manure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we are hoping to make a history web page, so when you go on to the Fairfield Association website, there will be a heading on the history. So things like the photographs of the metal detectors, finds, links to the different talks and things will all be associated on that page. And also possibly a history blog, so that if people are interested in asking a question or recording an observation, they'd be able to do that on the website. So that's a sort of development that's coming, I think, not too far ahead. Sorry, that was John there.
I was just thinking about the White House and the kind of, well, and the kind of Lotsonness of it all, but because the Fauna Fields are half owned by City Council, so at some point, I missed the Lotson talk, probably you will know this, but at some point they must have compulsory purchase those fields off the Loxons for educational purposes, because it was the playing fields, wasn't it, for people I know used to play football from Dallas Road School in what's now Fauna, etc. And then I think it got it back into the evil clutches of the City Council when the kind of education thing fell apart or it was disbanded or something. But also the City Council got its evil clutches on the White House, so the City Council owned that. So I don't quite know how they managed it, but then as part of the Fauna deal, the Loxons were very keen to be able to have it back again. City Council didn't want them to let them have it back again, but they kind of eventually did, and it happened. So, you know, it's almost like it's come back to its rightful owners, but what I'm interested in is how did the City Council get its claws on the White House for?
Can I just make one sort of correction there, in that the farmers were all tenant farmers.
So they never owned their land?
No.
Yeah,
and
certainly Robin talks about his grandfather leasing the land.
Yes, they were tenants. But how the City Council came in, I don't know.
The City Council, I know they've got the land, but I don't know how they got the White House.
I suspect it might be related to originally, I think, I remember speaking to the county surveyor about this, and he said that he had seen plans that, you know, actual. Plans for development of those fields, that there were housing estates planned, people had drawn it up, and there was a secondary school supposed to be there as well. So maybe the White House is part of that acquisition that was going to be for development, but then it all fell apart. I think Vista the Sky was retired now, but I think these plans had all happened before he'd even started working as the county surveyor. He had memories of these developments and the fact that the roads didn't quite work, or the roads weren't wide enough for the ratio of people who would be on houses on those lands, then those plans sort of fell apart and were shelved somewhere in County Hall where they now gathered us, thankfully. But I suspect that the compulsory purchase was probably related to the fact that they were originally going to be developed.
Could I just say one other thing about the work, the Carhouse Farm, because your daughter has asked the question. Person to talk to is Fraser. It's not ancient history, but Fraser grew. This is the grazier of the White Park cattle. He now lives in Carhouse Farm, and he remembers growing up there.
Edinburgh.
And he remembers growing up there, and has got stories, I think, of, you know, the outside trivia and stuff like that, which you might, as I say, it's not ancient history, but I think it is quite fun to hear about it. That is Fraser to talk. To talk to about it. I think he also has taken an interest in the history of that, so he may have quite a lot of knowledge
We're getting close to Halloween, and Fraser's also told me about how that lane is haunted by a
Well, there you are. You see, he's been there all day.
Right. The person I'll not believe is.
There is one other feature shown on the map which I'm mildly curious about. Cromwell's Mound, which predictably is just near Cromwell Road. There must be a story attached to that. Is it apocryphal or is there really a Cromwell connection? It's shown on the map.
Yeah, it's in the earlier maps, isn't it? The maps before the 1913 one show Cromwell's Mound, which is in the white area that we see between the canal, that area there, which of course,
other side.
Bottom. That's actually where we live at the moment.
Sorry.
but it was a market garden in Victorian times. Actually at the bottom of Cromwell Road, you can see some maps that actually show where the market garden was run from. But the whole of that white patch there was a market garden. Mm-hmm.
It was a market garden when I was a boy, or it was a greenhouse as well. Yeah. To the right, when you come down the slope, Cromwell Road.
Yeah.
The greenhouse is what had a terrible job, it flooded from Lucy Brook.
Mm. Yeah.
And at times it was closed, as was, funnily enough, we used to play football on the corner with Dallas Road Primary School. And that was closed because it flooded in bad winters.
Yeah.
And that's what finished the market garden.
So that comes back to your point about the water. Yeah. Ian?
Well, just to come to Philip's map reference, the map in question shows Cromwell's Mound as a raised feature. And it might be that either when the gardens were developed or when the houses were developed that they flattened it. But the map does show a raised feature which no longer exists. So there was some sort of mound there. What it had to do with Cromwell is a moot point.
Well, the story I heard was that was when he put his guns, shot at the castle.
He said, what are guns going to all around Lancaster? They said, this is where Cromwell's guns are.
Yes, it's not about Cromwell, it's about the market gardens, and there was Richard Green, who was the in a house that's still, I think it's called Rosebank, and it's near the footbridge. Because we lived in the south end of Regent Street in one of our deeds. I think it was Richard Green who owned all those lands, didn't he? And sold them to the developers who built Orchid Road and Regent Street. And on our deeds, it actually has Lousy Brook rather than.
Yes,
Lousy. You're gone back on the lousy program.
No, we have the same deeds, and some of them going back to the 1690s, and they refer to Lousy Brook. But also, yes, the guy who ran the market garden was, I think, Richard Green. Yeah.
Someone else trying to make a point? Nick?
Well, about Cromwell's Mound, I mean, I don't think there is actually any historical evidence to suggest that Cromwell got any nearer Lancaster than the rest of although the parliamentary arms yet been there, so it's probably one of those metonymic things. Yeah.
Yes.
Various places to figure
out. Rather interesting thing there was Ripley Heights, you know how it comes down. There were platforms with a cannon. Now in those days, as you know, the cannon would never reach the castle from there. And the other one, Cromwell Road, was called as one of Cromwell's cannonballs landing there. The cannon hill was supposed to be where he did have cannon.
Right.
I think Zora wrote a bit Josh, man.
Any other comments or questions?
Just one then, if I may.
Oh!
Sorry, another one. Yes, you pondered a little bit about the name of Aldcliffe Lane on the map.
Yes.
As if it might be different from Aldcliffe Road. The map shows it as Aldcliffe Lane, which is...
that's why I wondered whether it was
the
same.
Which is also not the present Aldcliffe Road.
Yeah. And that's for the flax factory.
Yeah, when they process the flax and then
made sailcloth there for the shipping.
I wondered if it was a part of Alpith, what's now Alpith Road, where the student flats are now, which I think at one stage was much more industrial. So that might have been why you had to have the flats factory.
Question about the flax. Did the flax come in raw or did it come in processed?
It came in raw.
Because you had to wrap it.
Yeah, the people, there's different names for the different jobs that people did. So flax, there was flax dressing before they went on to flax spinning and weaving. And they created sailcloth from that.
And I was just wondering, because to get flax in a condition to be able to weave it or spin it, it's got to be wetted, and to wet it you have to put it in a wet place.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
That's right, about where all that water was
from. I don't know which part of Walford Lane this factory was, but
I suspect
the family had connections with Walford, so it's anyone's guess.
Perhaps a bit of studying concrete tank or wetting tank.
Well, I'm going to, if people want to carry on chatting or raising any of the things, then I'm sure there'll be some people hanging around afterwards, possibly only drinking a bar, so please feel free to join us there. But meanwhile, I'd like to thank Ruth very much. I was very interested in the form of the presentation, using this different sort of software which I've never seen before, which I think was extremely effective and really did generate some interesting points and some interesting questions. So thank you very much, Ruth. As this is the end, really, of this programme, and it more or less marks the end of our project, I just asked Mick if he'd just wind that up for us and say one or two words.
You could.
But yes, this is the last of our 16 floral lectures, which have all been funded by the Heritage Lottery Fund, which is why we have this thing here every time. And I think it might be worth just recording what we have been doing in the last sort of year and a half. So the Heritage Lottery Fund has actually been really helpful for us. I mean, first of all, they contributed £80,000 towards the project when we were trying to buy the flora fields, £80,000 which went towards buying the fields but also securing our boundaries. So the first fences that were put in, some of the ones that on the boundary of our land, were paid for by the Heritage Lottery Fund. In addition to that, we got another £17,000 roughly from them for the educational project which we've been running for the last 18 months. So in addition to these 16 lectures, we've done lots of other things too. So there have been visits elsewhere to other nature reserves, to a local apiary and so on. And there's also been a series of visits to flora itself. Some of the Go Wild activities that we've been having in the Nature Reserve of late have been partly funded by the Heritage Lottery Fund. But they've done lots of other things for us too, in the sense that they've given us money to enable us to do things. So we've also had quite a big schools programme running, which I guess most of you will probably know about. Tony Finn at the back has been in charge of this. We've been taking a group of tutors into local primary schools, 8 local primary schools, 11 classes in those primary schools. They've had a series of half-day sessions in the schools themselves, and then, as Tony was referring to earlier, those classes have been brought out to Coney Wood earlier on in the summer, and there's been a session up there as well. In addition to that, we're beginning some cooperation with Ripley
secondary school, they have interest in perhaps working with us in various ways. They've already produced a stand for the nose pump, which is now in the West Field and is being used to provide drinking water for the cattle. We're hoping that eventually they will produce some finger posts pointing in various directions along the footpath. The next thing that the Lottery Fund have managed to help us to do relates to the volunteers. As you know, Ian runs our big volunteers program. We had 32 volunteers the last Saturday morning session, which I think is a record. That project has provided us with more money for tools. We always need more volunteers' tools. Whatever we do, we need more. But it's also provided us with quite a lot of money for training. So we've had people trained in various ways, including three or four people going on a three-day chainsaw training course, which of course they're now using to lay the hedges. We laid one hedge line along the West Field last winter. We'll be laying one next to the public footpath during this winter, and then another one the winter afterwards. And finally, the Heritage Lottery Fund have paid for the public exhibition, which some of you will have come to, which was in town 2 or 3 weeks ago, a two-day public exhibition. So they've done an enormous amount for us, and I would just like to record our thanks. It would be difficult, if not impossible, to have done all those things without them. Soon we'll be wrapping up that project and hopefully getting the last tranche of funding, but let's keep our fingers crossed in the meantime. I think we're all very proud of what we've done, and we're very thrilled by the fact that so many people have come to these lectures showing how much interest there is locally in what we've been doing. And of course the money hasn't just come from the Heritage Lottery Fund. The largest amount by far has come from local people giving us money to buy the fields. Much more for that than anything else. And we've also been getting funding from Natural England. All of those gates that were put in and the scrapes that we've done in the various fields and all sorts of other things, including the planting of the extra trees between Ponywood and Littlewood that we put in last winter. All of that is coming out of the high-level stewardship funding that we get from Natural England. And again, we wouldn't have been able to do what we have managed to do so far without them. So I think not only are we proud, but we're also very thankful that we've had all these different streams of funding to enable us to do what we've done. We haven't finished, however. So we're hoping that in the next 12 months at some point we might have a few more lectures. Nothing like as many as we've had this year because we don't have any funding left for them now, but we think it would be a good idea to try and keep the lecture tradition going, so we might have, let's say, 3 or 4 during the next 12 months or so. But there are other things also continuing. So the metal detecting, which Ruth was referring to, hasn't finished. So far, the metal detectors have only done their detecting in one field, the field that we now call Flora Field, the one that the arable crop was in this year. They're going to continue looking on the other fields. They're starting with the ones we own, and I'm just in the middle of the process of getting formal permission for them to be able to do the metal detecting on the fields which the City Council own and which we now lease as well. So there may well be more discoveries coming from that. And Sue is already in touch with an academic, an archaeologist down in the University of Central Lancashire, and we're hoping to have a field walking event on Flora Field at some point in the early spring to try and see if we can pick up all of the various things that have been pulled up to the surface by the ploughing that was done last spring. There are more things yet to come. I'm sure that lots of people are expecting the footpath that we said that we would put in around Ponywood, going from the public footpath around Ponywood and out to Walker's Road. We haven't done anything about that yet because basically we haven't had time. There aren't that many of us, and we've been working pretty hard on all the things that we've done so far. But one of our next big steps will be to try to raise the money to put the footpath in and to, in some ways, improve a bit the public footpath that runs now in between our fields. That's going to cost a lot of money. I doubt that we're going to be managing it for less than about £100,000, and it may well be a bit more than that. We're in the middle at the moment of getting the detailed plans drawn up so that we can apply for planning permission to do the work, and only then can we reasonably start campaigning for the money, so we'll be doing that sometime soon. And of course there will be more things going on all the time. The hedge laying, for example, the hedge laying working party is about to start this winter's work to lay one of the hedges along the side of the public footpath, as I mentioned before. And clearly there are still lots of historical conundrums that we need to try and find answers to. We could do with a good professional local historian who might come along and volunteer to find out the answers to our conundrums for us. But what I want to do is just to thank you all for coming, not just tonight, but in all of those other nights when we've been doing things over the last year. Thank you for your interest and your support. If we're going to continue with the Nature Reserve and make it work well, basically we're all going to have to continue working together on it forever. There's no other way of doing it. And that means that not only the people here, but the people who we don't know about yet and who are going to follow them are going to have to be persuaded to do this. So it's a community effort that I'm afraid is going to continue until the end of time.
I didn't put out on the stage, if anybody didn't see them on the way in, our latest leaflets about the Nature Reserve, which we have done for the public exhibition. We have spare copies of them if anybody wants to take them.